Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Welcome to today's episode of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Vita. St. John Paul II said that the family's role in evangelization is primary and irreplaceable. Owing to this, you and I need to ask ourselves, what has happened to the work of evangelization in the homes? Because statistics are showing that over 80% of children raised in Catholic homes, devout or otherwise, are not returning to the faith. They no longer practice. And the median age where this is being showed is about 23. We have to take a good look at this. We have to ask ourselves, why does our current approach to evangelization not take? It's failing our children. We can talk about what's happening at the level of the family with Dr. Greg Popchek, who joins us every week to speak about marriage and the family in light of church teachings and the theology of the body. After that, we will speak with Miles Wernz about homeschooling for the common good. It's no surprise that many people, and I argue that many of you who are listening to this program probably have thought about this, that there are concerns about the public education system or even institutional education systems in the United States at large. And this prompts many of us to ask ourselves, what does the future of education look like? And for many of us who are parents of young children, what does the future of my child's education look like? Well, Miles Wernz wants to propose a certain solution that he and his bride discovered during the COVID pandemic. It resulted in him having absolutely no choice. And this is something that they did. And eventually, their views on homeschooling not only changed, they now go on to continue to homeschool for the sake of the common good of their children and the society that they live in. And finally, we talk with a friend of mine, Phil Campbell, about his new book, Catholicism and the Pursuit of Wisdom. There's always been a rapprochement between the scientific method and scientific inquiry in light of divine revelation. The Church has always been at the forefront of pushing for the exercise of the natural sciences because the Church is unafraid. The discovery of nature and the world is reading from the book of nature that we may come to deeper savor the book of divine revelation. Phil Campbell talks with us about this. Let's take a look at the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Tuesday, August 13th. It's the feast of Blessed Michael Joseph McGivney. The U.S. is preparing for a potential Iranian attack on Israel. Pentagon Press Secretary Major General Pat Ryder.
The secretary reiterated the United States' commitment to take every possible step to defend Israel.
A guided missile submarine and aircraft carrier strike group have been deployed to the region as Israel braces for retaliatory attacks from Iran and its proxies following the assassination of senior members of Hamas and Hezbollah. Over 1.3 million people turned into Elon Musk's conversation with former President Trump on X. Some technical issues delayed the conversation, but the pair still spoke for over 2 hours. They discussed the attempted assassination of Trump in Pennsylvania, as well as immigration, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the threat of global warming. President Biden will address the Democratic National Convention next week in Chicago. He's expected to deliver a speech during the convention's opening night, highlighting his partnership with Vice President Harris, who is now the Democratic nominee for president. The Oklahoma Supreme Court is ruling that an online religious school isn't legal. The court terminated the Oklahoma Charter School Board's contract with St. Isidore of Seville Catholic Virtual School. If the contract had been upheld, St. Isidore would have become the nation's first public religious school. Researchers at USC have found a link between the daily smoking of marijuana and cancer.
There's kind of perception out there that cannabis use can be beneficial, but, you know, everything can come at a risk.
Dr. Niles Cocott is the head and neck surgeon with Keck Medicine. He says that those that smoke cannabis are 5 times more likely to develop cancer in the mouth and throat than those who do not smoke. His study found that fumes from cannabis may even be worse than tobacco smoke. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. As I mentioned in the open earlier, St. John Paul II said that the family's role in evangelization is primary and irreplaceable. And perhaps this is one of those main elements of the evangelization and formation of the faith of our children that we might have taken for granted. Because we have to ask ourselves, why does the church's approach to evangelization seem to overlook this today? We depend on churches, schools, institutions, apostolates to do this. Families need to be first. Joining me to have this conversation is Dr. Greg Popchak, who joins us every week. He's the director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, a group pastoral telecounseling practice that provides Catholic integrated marriage, family, and individual counseling services to Catholics around the world. He and his bride, Lisa, also hosts the More to Life, the program More to Life, produced by Ave Maria Radio and aired across EWTN. Greg, it's great to speak with you again.
Good to be here, Marcus. Thank you.
So let's dive right into this. We do have a statistical issue when it comes to talking about the evangelization of Catholic children, because as you mentioned, the numbers are close to, 85% of children who grow up in Catholic homes wind up leaving and never practicing the faith again.
That's right, yeah. And often between the ages of 11 and 13 is when they say that their faith has died, essentially. And so and parents don't realize that until the kids go to college. When they stop going to church, you know, it's just easier to go through the motions for those, you know, 5 to 7 years that the kids are still at home. But they've lost their faith, like I said, between 11 and 13.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a serious epidemic of you know, a spiritual crisis that, I don't think it's become so common that we all just shrug. Yeah, when we see that. But, you know, to say that we're losing 85% of our children to the world is just devastating. And something needs to be done. And in fact, there are simple things that could be done.
Yeah. And, you know, Greg, even as we're talking about this, I used to teach at a high school, a local Catholic high school. And if we found out that there was a university that had an 85% failure rate, as in 85% of students who graduate from that university couldn't get jobs, we'd think, okay, gosh, that's not a university we want to be affiliated with.
Away their accreditation. Yeah,
right.
Like, it would be a huge scandal.
Right. But this is the faith here. This is the eternal salvation of the souls of our children. We really ought to seriously look at this. So what's failing in the family?
Well, you know, basically the families aren't getting any support or training on how to evangelize our children. So you quoted St. John Paul, who said that the family's role in evangelization is primary and irreplaceable. Unfortunately, everything about the church's approach to evangelization is secondary and remedial. It tends to assume that the family has already failed, and so we have to evangelize individuals. But even those approaches fail because we evangelize individuals, they experience an encounter with Christ, and then they go home. And their newly enlivened faith gets squashed by their unchurched spouse or the discouragement of their children or extended family. You know, so even if you go through a wonderful program like Alpha or any of the wonderful adult evangelization programs that do exist, they can have less effectiveness because these people go home and the faith gets squashed. And so we need to really have a family approach to evangelization, because even, you know, when one is evangelized, we should be evangelized into something, into a community,
right,
of faith that can support us. And so the family is God's first small faith group. But we don't treat it that way. We treat it as this sort of thing that exists out there, and it's nice if it works, well, if it doesn't. And we have to really completely reform our approach. I'm not saying, by the way, that these more individual or remedial approaches to evangelization aren't important. Of course they are. I mean, there are always going to be people who fall through the cracks.
Mm-hmm.
And these structures need to be there.
Yep.
But the metaphor I like to use is that the church is like a circus that has really big nets, but doesn't train the acrobats to do their act. So we keep thinking, you know what we need to do? We need to invest in bigger and bigger nets.
Right.
These people keep falling. Like, well, how about we train the acrobats to do their job? And that's what St. John Paul's vision was, to train families, to equip families to raise their children in the faith, to raise the next generation of missionary disciples. But that hasn't taken off because we have this very individualistic and remedial approach to evangelization. When I say remedial, I mean, that we assume that the family, which is the primary and irreplaceable approach to evangelization, is going to fail.
Yep.
And so we need to do something to make up for that. Right. And so we have this very individualistic, kind of silo-driven approach mm-hmm. to evangelization that emphasizes the individual over the community of the family.
You know, Greg, you and your bride and your institute have been at the forefront of trying to evangelize families and arm families, especially parents, with the tools necessary to create liturgical homes, domestic churches.
Yes.
And frankly, I've only been Catholic in a Vatican II church, so I haven't, outside of what I've read, I don't know what pre-Vatican II looked like. But it would appear that a big part of the Second Vatican Council's call for empowering the laity has created avenues for the schooling of families into how to form domestic churches.
It has, yes. And so that universal call to holiness has been essential in really many of the ministries that have developed since then. The problem is, and we've talked about this before in this segment, that the universal call to holiness didn't result in new approaches to spirituality that treat the busyness and craziness and messiness of family life as a feature instead of a bug.
Yeah.
The most of what we think of as Catholic spirituality is drawn from the more monastic and clerical traditions, mm-hmm. and they're beautiful and they're important and valuable, and people can draw a lot from them. But, the big insight from that universal call to holiness was, maybe we should teach families to do the Liturgy of the Hours. That's a lovely idea, but there's a tiny minority of families who are actually going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to actually show families how to use the stuff of family life as an opportunity to encounter Christ and grow in holiness. And I think that's what St. John Paul was about when he promoted St. Thérèse of Lisieux to a doctor of the church, because he saw that her little way of holiness was a pathway of holiness for families.
Right.
Doing small things with great love every day with their spouse and their children, and growing in holiness in using the stuff of everyday family life. But we really haven't cultivated that in any kind of systematic or meaningful way. And so, parents continue to get the message that, if you go to church every Sunday, and then, which of course we all should, but if you go to church on Sunday, then, the rest of it will just work itself out. And it doesn't, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Last week,
our kids end up falling through the cracks.
Last week, you mentioned that one of the metrics of successful families, the 15%, was that they came from huggy families because the love in their faith overflowed into the affection they showed for their children. Just comment a little more on that.
Sure. So we did a study through the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate that looked at families who successfully raised all of their children to a faithful adulthood. Whether they had 2 or 10 children, all these children were faithful adult Catholics. And we looked at what were the family dynamics that contributed to that. And we interviewed both the adult children and the parents and asked them to describe their families and describe their approach to faith formation. And one of the words that kept coming up in the interviews over and over again was huggy, that these were very affectionate families. In fact, there were about 12 different practices that these families exhibited, from prioritizing family time to being affectionate, to having good rituals for working and playing and talking and praying together, to doing things to reach out to their parish or their community together as a family. They really saw their faith as something that was lived at home first, and everything that happened outside the home, including mass attendance or Catholic school or youth groups or any of that, was secondary and supportive to their primary and irreplaceable efforts to evangelize each other in the home. We talk about this on our app, Catholic yep. Home. It's Catholic HOM. It stands for Households on Mission. And we walk families through how to live this, what we call Liturgy of Domestic Church Life, mm-hmm. that enables families to learn and practice those 12 habits that families who successfully raise all of their children to a faithful adulthood do. And, of course, we don't make any guarantees. There are no silver bullets. Every person is an individual. Every family is in a unique situation. But we believe that these habits will help every family do a better job of raising the next generation of faithful Catholics.
Greg, I love these segments, and they're very edifying for me, too. I go home and I hug my children just a little tighter every time. Thank you for your time. My guest has been Dr. Greg Popchak, Director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, and he and his bride, Lisa, host More to Life, produced by Ave Maria Radio and aired across EWTN. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus.
Location, location, location. These are the 3 most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
When I've had enough. I ask parents, when do you decide to discipline? One of the most common answers is, when I've had enough. If discipline is designed to teach, then we need to discipline before we've had enough. We need to discipline because the behavior's wrong, not because emotionally it's pushed us to our edge. Besides, when you get to when you've had enough, you're much more likely to yell and scream and say things that you have to go to confession for. So, the suggestion is, discipline out of principle, not emotion. Principle means because it needs discipline, and I'm going to do it when I'm calm. Emotion means I'm going to be moved to do it just because I'm mad.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization. Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Miles Wernz is the author of From Isolation to Community, A Renewed Vision of Christian Life Together. He writes at Christian Ethics in the Wild and teaches at Abilene Christian University. And he never thought he would ever be a homeschooling parent, but when the COVID pandemic gave him no choice, it also presented an opportunity for him and his bride to start homeschooling their children for 1 year. Gradually, his views on homeschooling changed, and he joins us to speak about that. Miles, it's really good to speak with you.
Yes, it's good to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
No problem at all. So I want to start by asking, what was it about homeschooling that you and your bride initially did not like or didn't desire to do?
Oh, I don't think we had any real objections to it. We just had never really considered it.
Mm-hmm.
When we first moved to Abilene, I think we do what a lot of people do, is we had one young child at the time, and so I started thinking about where we would like to live, proximity to schools, and thinking about, organizing our lives accordingly. And then 2020 came around, and that kind of threw our lives into a different kind of space where we had to consider other sorts of options. So I remember very specifically, it was spring of 2020 prior to having to enroll them for the coming fall. And COVID was on the rise, and I don't think anybody really had clear instruction as what things would look like in the fall. But none of the scenarios for kindergarten was especially great. And so we thought, yeah, we can do this. We can try. This is kind of an emergency situation. We can do this for 1 year, and then but then we'll re-enroll in first grade and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was kind of the beginning. That was the beginning of it. It was something that I think we had really entertained prior to that time.
Right, and in your own words, if the COVID pandemic had not forced your hand, this homeschooling your children might still have been a remote possibility, let alone a consideration at all.
Right. It takes a lot more time. It takes a lot more intention. It takes a lot of reconfiguring of your home space and of schedules and of thinking about how our jobs and our educational priorities and all of those things weave together. It's just a lot of thought, a lot of intention.
But there have been societal ramifications to your family's choice to not enroll in the local public school, especially in terms of funding for enrollment.
Right. So, I mean, in one sense, everyone who pays property tax like we do supports the local districts. I don't know how it is in other states, but at least in the state of Texas, that taxes coming from property are one of the large ways that school systems are funded. There's other mechanisms, but that's kind of the major one.
Mm-hmm.
And so by being a homeowner, that was kind of a default for us. Now there are that's not the only way that school districts are allocated funds on the basis of how many students have enrolled. If they do have fewer students enrolled, then that affects how many teachers can be hired, the sorts of funding that are discretionary for districts, what sorts of programming they get to offer, those kinds of things. And so that was one thing that we really had to wrestle through, was knowing that on the one hand, we thought, yeah, this is absolutely seems to be the thing that that seems to be the prudent choice for us as a family to do, while acknowledging, yeah, there are real ramifications. And I think we're seeing some of those nationwide. Enrollment in public schools nationwide is down, and with that, school budgets are down accordingly because fewer students, fewer dollars for public schools.
However, you and your bride have seen some market benefits to having undertaken the effort of homeschooling. So while on the one hand the common good might have been affected by the amount of money that the public school might have received, on the other hand, the common good is being furthered by the benefits that your children and your family are being are receiving.
Right. I think it's offered us as a family an opportunity to introduce, as a part of the curriculum that we started, the way that we... the way we do it is we're a part of a 3-day-a-week school that is comprised of other homeschooling parents. So we have certified teachers that do language arts and fine arts and math and games, you know, like a lot of the socialization aspects.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mondays and Fridays, they're at home with us. And but during the summers, we do a lot of work as well. The stuff that we have. So the benefits have been that we're able to introduce as part of the ordinary curriculum, just a lot of other additional thing and additional things that we think would be beneficial for them. We've been able to like potentially incorporate conversations around faith into a lot of different disciplinary aspects, theology and ethics professionally. So nice to be able to kind of think about, okay, so what might be the appropriate way to introduce these things to, you know, someone who's going into the fourth grade, someone who's going into the second grade. I spend those kinds of benefits. But I think one of the other benefits that I see as I kind of watch homeschooling as a national phenomenon now in a way that I didn't before, is seeing that there are ways in which school pedagogy operate that may actually provide instruction, well, may offer some lessons for how public education operates.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there. So when I think about, okay, what are the things that we as a family have had to do, had to prioritize voluntarily, had to think about, like what are the material things that have made this possible for us?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about, okay, so if these are the things that have made that really materially make come possible, what might happen if we start introducing these things as part of public education? What happens if we begin to actively incorporate parental involvement at a large scale within public education? That happens already, but like one of the keys that have obviously key to homeschool. But what happens when we begin to do that like more regularly within a public school frame? What happens when you begin to introduce student choice or student initiative into like some educational choices? So rather than saying all students need to proceed in this this direction with respect to your curriculum, what happens when we begin to kind of offer some tutoring for particular student interests or particular student aptitude? What happens when you begin to incorporate, say, other sorts of trade sorts of things or other sorts of interests to the curriculum. I just think that, like, the flexibility of homeschooling offers a lot. It offers the ability for homeschooling to be kind of a test ground or to kind of pilot some things that I think in the long run that public schooling could work for, could work for public schooling. This has honestly been one of the biggest challenges for my wife and myself when thinking about education, that we do fully support public schooling. And so thinking about how is what we do with our own, with the education of our own children, how might it be a benefit and a blessing to not just our community, but to public schooling more specifically?
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us, Miles. How can people reach you really quickly?
Yeah, so I write a Substack. It's, you look up Christian Ethics Wild. That's right, times a week. They can find me online. I've written frequently for Christianity Today. I teach at Christian University. I have a really uncommon last name, so Wernt, W-E-R-N-T-Z. If you Google it, you'll find me pretty quickly. So.
All right, thank you, Miles. God bless you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My guest has been Miles Wernt, author of From Isolation to Community, and the real lesson we can take away from this is that we have to understand that the moral obligation of the education of children is a gift that God has given to parents. So you as parents, as you're listening to this, understand that not the institution, not the school, public or private or whatever, can take that away from you. The most priceless thing you can do for your child is to be involved in their formation unto sainthood. Stay tuned for the next segment. I'm Marcus Peter.
Support for this Ave Maria radio program comes in part by the non-for-profit St. Anthony Services. Are you shopping for mortgage products, Catholic investing, Catholic health, real estate, or estate planning? StAnthonyServices.org can help you find a Catholic professional for these needs. They regularly connect faithful citizens with faith-based professionals that share our Christian values. More information at StAnthonyServices.org or 877-LIFE-US1.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Every year, couples who go on the Ave Maria Radio's Good News Cruise testify how their marriages are revitalized and transformed. Join us on the next Good News Cruise from January 5th to 11th on the Royal Caribbean's Oasis of the Seas. You'll be joined by Father Michael Schmitz, Teresa Tamio, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and many more speakers. Cabins are selling fast, so be sure to book your spot now. Faith and fun on the sea and in the sun. There's no topping that. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the travel tab to find out more.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Do you have a hard time getting your kids to open up? Maybe it's time to take a different approach. Kids, and especially teens, have a hard time with "we need to talk" times. They tend to be afraid that they're going to be judged or criticized or lectured, so they shut down before they've even had a chance to open up. On the other hand, kids are much more likely to open up if you're spending time together on some activity. Fixing the car, baking cookies, shopping, taking a walk. It really doesn't matter so much what you're doing. It matters that you're creating the space you need for conversations to happen naturally. That's why taking time for family talk rituals is an important part of Catholic family life. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life,
Visit CatholicCounselors.com.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
St. Ignatius of Loyola introduces the sixth rule of his 14 rules for the discernment of spirits, calling to mind the directive of the fifth rule. In the fifth rule, St. Ignatius directs us not to change our spiritual decisions or proposals when we are in a time of spiritual desolation. The sixth rule states, although in desolation we should not change our first proposals, it is very advantageous to change ourselves intensely against the desolation itself. The call on the sixth rule is to change ourselves, intensely against the spiritual desolation. We are not called to passively endure spiritual desolation, for God's call in the time of spiritual desolation is always to resist and fight against the desolation with strength, trust, and determination. How will you change yourself against the desolation?
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The relationship between the Catholic Church and science is one of the most misunderstood stories in the entirety of Western civilization. Merely repeating the mantra that there is no ultimate contradiction between faith and reason, unfortunately, hasn't solved the epistemological crisis of not only millions of Catholics, but even those who espouse to scientism in the materialist public sphere. Many Catholics have abandoned their faith over perceived discrepancies between religion and science. Here to talk with us about his new book that is an effort to help engage this perceived discrepancy is Philip Campbell. He is a friend. He's a high school history teacher for Homeschool Connections. He's a popular Catholic historian, and he also runs Cruachan Hill Publishing. Phil, it is great to speak with you. How do you do?
Hi, Marcus. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, the joy is completely mine, brother. So let's start with, you're a historian, and I love that you utilize your historical capacity to engage this debate from the lens of the Church. It's baffling to me that I even espoused to that kind of an empiricist worldview as if it is contrary to the faith, but that began somewhere.
Yeah, it did. There's a common misperception that the doctrines of the faith are incompatible with modern science. And as you said in your introduction, people in the Church will often repeat, no, there's no contradiction, there's no contradiction. But that hasn't really been helping communicate the message. When I was researching for this book, I looked into a lot of statistics about why young people are leaving the Church, or why they're abandoning Christianity. Why young people today abandon Christianity is because of perceived conflict between faith and science. And so while you have people out there, you know, like Bishop Robert Barron or different Catholic intellectuals who are trying to make the case that there's no contradiction, it's not necessarily landing. So I was very interested in this because I think going right back to John Paul II with Fides et Ratio, which is a brilliant encyclical, my personal favorite of his, and all the way to today, there's been so many efforts to try to demonstrate how these two aspects of human knowledge go together. But it's still not getting across to many young people. These are people in the Church who are turning away from the faith because of this perceived contradiction. So I wanted to delve a little deeper. I wanted to go into the history and see what the real relationship between the Church and science was, and see if I could get a little further into this subject for people who wanted to kind of chew on it and get beyond just the talking points.
Mm. So let's talk about getting beyond those talking points. You went back to John Paul II. I'd like to take us all the way back first to the Scriptures. And you highlight this in your book too, that, for example, with John the Apostle's engagement of Christ as the Logos and his logocentric Christology. But then after that, you move forward, you see Paul talking about how the imprints of God are found in nature, in the Romans 1:20. And then after that, Justin Martyr in the second century writing about how we read from two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Divine Revelation. From its earliest annals, the Church has been such a stalwart proponent of the study of nature and its natural sciences for the sake of greater understanding the revelations of the deposit of faith.
Yes, and you find this, and I'm glad you brought up that passage from the first chapter of Romans, where Paul says that in the creation, the Creator is seen. So when we look at the created world, we're essentially seeing God's handiwork. And this is an idea that comes right from the Old Testament. You go back to the wisdom literature, and it talks about how creation is like a mirror that reflects the power and the majesty of God. And so in Christianity, from the very beginning of the Church, you have this idea that because creation comes from God, it's eminently rational, it's understandable.
Yep.
And because it comes from God, it's also going to be a reflection of Him. And so there's this sense in which the study of the natural world, how the natural world functions, is a path to understanding the divine. And so throughout to the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, there's this idea that to pursue science is an eminently suitable thing for religious-minded people to do. And in fact, if you look at the type of training that medieval or Renaissance clergy were expected to have, so much of it was scientific. I was really surprised by how much scientific training and reading they were expected to do. So Christianity has really nourished scientific inquiry in the West.
You think about, for example, one of the greatest scientists in church history, Albert the Great. Many people don't realize that we owe the heritage of the scientific method, the system of scientific inquiry, to its genesis in him and the way he explored the grand reality of the natural sphere as revealing God.
Yeah, Albert had a nickname, Dr. Universalis, which loosely translated as the doctor of everything there is to know, or the universal doctor, because of it. His inquiry was so broad. He did studies in optics and in chemistry, and he studied the weather, and he looked at plants, and the man was endlessly curious, and not just content to read the old authors, to read Aristotle or the Greeks, but he wanted to carry out his own observations. You mentioned in the genesis of the scientific method, that is doing what the medieval natural philosophers called an experimentum, which was making observations about the things they actually saw and how things in the world worked and trying to figure out the mechanisms behind them. And you really get that I think Albert popularized it, and then it continues to grow after him. But it was really great researching this book to see how oftentimes there's a narrative that, you know, the Middle Ages was just this ignorant time, and then all of a sudden the Enlightenment came and we have this scientific revolution.
Right.
But scientific revolutions don't come out of nowhere. Really, everything that happened during the Enlightenment was built on centuries upon centuries of incremental advancement due to the advances of people like Albert and medieval mathematicians, medieval astronomers, who were patiently studying the cosmos, trying to understand it. And really now, I think it's more accurate, and even secular historians are seeing this, it's more accurate to see the scientific advancements of the early modern period as coming in continuity with what came before them out of the Middle Ages. And I was really glad to see that even secular history is starting to acknowledge this.
And me too. I'm very heartened to see that, because what it's also effectively doing is getting out of this misconceived notion of this, like you mentioned, you know, this phase of idiocy in history that were the Dark Ages, and that this great boom in enlightenment and scientific revelation did away with the archaic structures of the faith, when in fact the reverse is true.
Yeah, the reverse is actually true. The faith has nourished inquiry, and I think responsible for the scientific advancement of the West by holding this up as an eminent profession that was suitable for religious people to pursue. And we all know that it's commonly repeated about how many craters on the moon are named after Jesuit astronomers, how many heavenly bodies are named after Jesuit scientists. So there's been so many ways that the church has contributed to this that it really is ridiculous to say the church has hindered science. And for those who want to pick up the book, and it's published by the good folks at Our Sunday Visitor, so thankful to work with them. There's a neat appendix in the back that I wrote that's about stories that people repeat about scientists who were allegedly persecuted by the church or executed by the church. And I go through and I look at everyone, and it, in no case was it ever justified that the church actually persecuted or executed someone for their scientific beliefs. Every single one was a myth, or it had been misconstrued. So debunked all of it.
Right. I love that Bruno is one of the people that you mentioned as well. And we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. My guest is Phil Campbell. He's a history teacher for Homeschool Connections, popular Catholic historian, and he is the author of In Pursuit of Wisdom, Catholicism and Science Through the Ages. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Location, location, location. These are the three most important factors in real estate. The same might be said for colleges. Trudging through snow to get to an 8 a.m. statistics class is a much different experience than breezing by a palm tree to the raucous applause of a laughing gull. With the average temperature of 84 degrees and wetland nature as your backdrop, it's no wonder students tend to stay once they visit our campus. Ave Maria University, your future location, location, location. Visit avemaria.edu.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
So when you see these different media outlets working directly in conjunction or conclusion with the government to suppress stories, what does that say to us about the reliability or lack thereof of the secular media? And then this is combined with a report that came out, a survey that was done on media executives. They interviewed 75 media leaders around the country, and they're saying we're done with objectivity. Well, that's not exactly a news flash. But the fact that they're claiming that objectivity is just no longer necessary and we are elitists, we know better, and this is what we're going to do, is frightening. And this is one of the reasons that we stress the importance of having outlets such as The Register and EW10 News Nightly and The World Over and Catholic News Agency and EW10 News In Depth.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
What are some of the common temptations against prayer? The Catechism claims that the most common yet hidden temptation is lack of faith, which is expressed not so much in a declaration of disbelief as our actual preferences. For instance, when we begin to pray, a thousand labors or cares vie for priority. This is a moment of truth for our heart. What is our heart's true love? Do we call on the Lord just as a last resort, or do we presumptuously call on Him as an ally? In each case, the Catechism says, we have not acquired the disposition of the humble heart, which remembers the Lord's words, "Apart from me, you can do nothing." A presumptuous heart may experience the temptation of acidia, defined as spiritual depression due to lax ascetical practice, decreasing vigilance, and carelessness of heart. As Jesus chastised his sleeping apostles in Gethsemane, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest is Philip Campbell, teacher for Homeschool Connections, popular Catholic historian, and author of In Pursuit of Wisdom, published by Our Sunday Visitor. So, Phil, we were talking earlier about some of the scandalous myths pertaining to the Church's relationship with scientists, and Bruno being one such individual. The myth of it is that the Church decided to silence him for the grand scientific cosmology that he was trying to espouse, when in reality, he was actually being tried for his denial of Christ's divinity.
Yeah, there was. So, Giordano Bruno was... he lived during the Renaissance. He was a Dominican friar, astronomer, poet, and he fell afoul of the Inquisition and was burned at the stake. And it's often asserted that he was burned because of his cosmological theories, because of his scientific beliefs. There's even a statue of Bruno in Italy that lifts him up as a martyr to science against against the oppressive Church. But Bruno was tried under 8 charges, and 7 of them were theological. He was charged with defaming the ministers of the Church, denying the Trinity, denying Christ's divinity, denying transubstantiation, teaching reincarnation of human souls, practicing magic, the things. Only one of the charges had to do with the universe or cosmology, and it really was more philosophical.
Yes, that's right.
It wasn't scientific. He was calling into question the theological truth of the universe as an eternal existence. So he wasn't tried for any scientific belief whatsoever. He was tried as a heretic. The Church did not try and execute people for scientific theories.
Right. In fact, very specifically, Bruno was being tried because he was holding on to positions, for example, like the notion of an eternal universe that was limitless. And he was doing this in willful contradiction to the notion of an eternal God who creates a finite universe. This was open defiance against not only revealed teachings, but also against the order of reason as it had been established prior to him.
Exactly. And, you know, you might look at the situation of Bruno and say, well, a man shouldn't be put to death for something like that. And we could certainly argue about that. But the fact is, this wasn't a scientific argument that he was engaged in with the Church. And somehow, and this myth comes from the 19th century, by the way, when the Italian nationalists were trying to set up an atheist secular state and dismantle the papal states. They adopted Bruno as a kind of martyr for their cause, and they are responsible for this myth. But there was really nothing pertaining to science in the case of Bruno whatsoever. It was a theological and philosophical dispute, as you noted.
So this then raises further questions for us. For example, the Ptolemaic geocentric view of the universe that unfortunately had a certain sense of prevalence at its time. And Copernicus's work that shed some light on the matter after the fact. The Church was involved, but it was actually far more positive than our modern historical annals would allow us to believe.
Yeah, when we look at the work of Copernicus, his work, it was sharply criticized when it first came out. So when Copernicus, so everybody knew that the Ptolemaic system was in trouble by the time of Copernicus. There was too many things it wasn't accounting for, and too many errors in the astronomical tables, and so there was all these attempts throughout the 1400s and 1500s to revise the Ptolemaic system, to kind of tweak the numbers to make it more functional. And Copernicus believed that these problems could best be explained by positing a heliocentric universe rather than a geocentric one. And this was met with criticism, mainly from other scientists. It was not religious fundamentalists who were critiquing Copernicus. It was other scientists who were bringing up criticisms, asking questions like, how do you account for the fact that the stars don't seem to move, or that the like, if the heliocentric model was correct, we should see Mercury going through phases like the moon, but we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were these various scientific objections. Churchmen actually were fairly enthusiastic about Copernicus. When you see some of the letters written to him by eminent cardinals and people in the church, they're supportive of it. He even dedicated his book to the Pope. So this is a myth where he was like persecuted. Copernicus was really had most of his opposition from other scientists because he needed to answer scientific criticisms of the theory, which wouldn't be able to be there when the modern telescope was invented. So it's a lot more intricate than many people think the story is.
As was the case with the Galilean controversy, the fact is Copernicus held a heliocentric model before Galileo did. Galileo held a heliocentric model as well, but only one of them was brought up on charges and investigated by the church, which tells us that it wasn't the heliocentric model itself that was the problem.
No, and Galileo's problem was more when, kind of like Bruno straying into theology, it's not just that Galileo is proposing a new model of the universe, which the Pope was even willing to consider at the time, but it was that Galileo's area of expertise in trying to explain how to exegete the scriptures to support his theory. So we see in his letter to Christina of Sweden, where he, or is it Denmark? Somebody will correct me, Denmark or Sweden. But in his letter to Christina, he is he's talking about ways to interpret the scriptures to support the heliocentric theory, and he starts expostulating on kind of like rules for exegetes, and he strays into theological territory and into philosophy, and that starts making the church very uncomfortable with it. And when you read the condemnation of Galileo, a lot of it has to do with his manner of exegeting the scriptures, and the church essentially saying that he's too rash and too bold in saying that this unproven theory, which was still very contested at the time, that we should reformulate how we've been interpreting scriptures for 1,500 years just to accommodate an unproven scientific theory. It's not the heliocentric theory per se that gets condemned.
Mm-hmm.
It's really wrapped up with Galileo's method of interpreting the scriptures.
Yeah.
And that does lead to the church to be suspicious of heliocentrism. And so you see there's kind of a de facto suppression of it for a century after the Galileo case. But by the mid-1800s, that had largely been ignored and was eventually revoked in the middle of the 1700s.
Well, thank you so much, Phil, for making the time to speak with us. How can people reach you if they're interested?
Yeah, I have a website, philipcampbell.net. So if you just want to go on philipcampbell.net, that's Philip with two L. Check out my work, and I have a contact form there if you need to get in touch with me, or on Facebook at Philip Campbell, author, teacher.
Well, thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you.
To recap the conversations that we've just had, there are numerous scientific figures that we can draw to the forefront when we talk about the support of the church when it comes to not just Catholic scientists in general, but also cleric scientists, priests, bishops who engage in science. One of my favorite ones is Father Georges Lemaître, who is actually the individual who gave the final equations necessary for Einstein's development for his theory of general relativity. And Father Georges Lemaître is the prodigy behind the math for the initial great expansion, or Big Bang, as one might call it. He was a Catholic scientist. His theory is held by virtually every atheist I have ever spoken to, and yet none of them know that he's a Catholic scientist. The reason why I bring this up is because, going back to the scriptures, it's very clear that there is a goodness to the order of creation. Everything has been created and put into this order to demonstrate the reality of the divine, which means that as Catholics, you and I do not have to be afraid to engage the sciences. If anything, my encouragement to all of you as you're listening is to start boldly engaging the sciences. Read journals, read scientific discoveries, read about these innovations, engage in engineering, find out about the new horizons that science is pushing, and always let our inquiry, always let the lens with which we view these things be the lens of faith. Our inquiry has to be tempered with what we know from divine revelation. So yes, the scientific sphere will allow us to, for example, this is a reality, to transplant wombs into people who are unable to have children. Now, does that mean that we morally now have a right to transplant wombs into biological men? Well, no, it presents a true biological, a true moral conundrum. Even if the science can be worked out very dangerously, but it can be worked out. And this is what you and I have to do. That all of the scientists that the church has brought up on charges, or that the church has tried, or even those that were burned at the stake and executed. Now, you might argue for the fact that you don't like that form of a punishment, but you have to understand that there's a historical context at play here. There was a point in time where this was a legitimate course of moral action. And since then, the church has moved away from it. And I think it is to her credence that she acknowledges it. She doesn't pretend that she has had a pristine history. Nonetheless, every one of those who have been tried, who have been brought up on charges, or who have been executed, were done so because the church was within her rights to try them and bring up those charges. And very often it had to do with heresy. Very often it had to do with doctrinal. It was philosophical issues that were brought up into theological spheres, Galileo being one such individual, that when he writes this letter to the Grand Duchess Christina of Tuscany, he encourages her to rethink her interpretation of the scriptures to fit his scientific heliocentric model. All of this is a problem. So science and faith are not at odds. Viewed through the lens of faith, science illuminates the deposit of revelation. Stay tuned for tomorrow's episode of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. Until then, I'm Marcus Peter.